Recently, the New York Times published a 10-page article on the front page of its Sunday magazine featuring the story of a semi-repentant blogger named Emily Gould. The story, which was written by Gould herself, was slammed by readers of the Times as being trivial and narcissistic. But according to some figures, a new blog is created every second of every minute of every hour of every day. They range in topic from politics to the minutiae of private lives. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickard, in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today we'll ask the question, is today's blogging mania contributing to public discourse or just dragging it through the muck? And what effect will blogging have on the coming presidential election and American culture? We're joined this hour by Andrew Keen, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and author of the book The Cult of the Amateur. His writing has appeared in The Weekly Standard, Fast Company, and the San Francisco Chronicle. We hope you'll join in today as well and tell us what's on your mind. Are you a blogger or a reader of blogs? Do you trust the information that you get from bloggers? And do you see blogging as a force of democratization or just a dumbing down of our culture? You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Andrew Keen, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
So, like lots of other people, you weren't so crazy about the New York Times' choice to run an article by blogger Emily Gould last Sunday. And for those who haven't read the article or haven't read the whole thing, can you just tell us a little bit what it was?
Well, it was entitled Exposed, and she certainly exposed herself. It was the cover story of the magazine. I don't have a problem with the subject. But I think the biggest problem was it was a very long cover piece on the magazine. It was, at least in terms of me downloading it from the computer, it was about 8 or 9 pages. And it was a terribly indulgent, fluffy piece that, in my view, should not have been published, certainly as a cover story on the New York Times, told me nothing new about this subject, and I think reflects our mania with self-expression and self-broadcast, but didn't do anything in terms of actually figuring out why people like Emily are doing these sorts of things.
Well, I'm not sure what the New York Times expected, but there was a huge outpouring against the piece. Thousands of readers emailed in and wrote, you know, they said some pretty mean things, and I'm sure Emily was, I don't know if she was expecting it. It sounds like she was expecting some of it, but maybe
not
the magnitude.
Well, the funny thing about the piece is that the whole piece is basically about Emily confessing to the world that she's ashamed by the fact that she's become a self-broadcaster and everyone's laughing at her. So what does she do? She goes and writes a long piece for the New York Times in which more people laugh at her, which humiliates her even more. I mean, there's certainly a degree of cultural sadomasochism here, and it's very hard to figure out, apart from the fact that obviously Emily probably wants to get a book deal or got well paid by the New York Times. So Emily's laughing here because it doesn't really matter to her, but the rest of us, I think, are rather bored and confused by really what's going on here. I think this makes the New York Times look a lot worse than Emily Gould.
Well, what do you think it is about this piece that touched such a nerve?
It's so inane. It's so teenagerish. There's this, you know, young girl. I mean, she doesn't write badly, but she certainly doesn't write very well, who writes a 9-page piece about how a blog undermined her relationship with her boyfriend, her parents, her sex life. She got more spots, more pimples. She was embarrassed by everyone. It's the kind of thing you'd expect in a teenage magazine, but not in the leading American newspaper.
Well, you can kind of see what the New York Times might have been thinking, that this was an insider's look at a huge cultural phenomenon, blogging. I mean, in your book, you talk about the incredible rate at which blogs are produced every second, every minute, every hour, every day. And why not get an insider's look at what happens when you take blogging to extremes?
I think that's fair. And I think the fact that it got a reaction shows that it was a relevant piece. And certainly the New York Times was looking for reaction. I think their magazine editor even acknowledged that. You know, I think when he was questioned, he said something like, well, you know, we published this so that we knew people would have strong feelings, and that's why we published it. I think there's some truth to that, although I would much rather someone wrote a more sociological piece about what I call digital Darwinism and why that's happening in our culture, and more of an explanatory piece about what leads us to be so obsessed with self-expression, particularly Emily's generation. I think this is a generational conflict, a generational misunderstanding. I think Emily, who's in her 20s, was writing this for her generation. The really interesting question is, of course, that most people who read the New York Times are not in their 20s. So I would have preferred something a little bit more analytical, a little bit more skeptical. But the fact that we're having this conversation, and the fact that many people responded critically and this became an issue of public discourse, in itself, I guess, in a way, justifies the publication of the piece.
Well, Emily is symptomatic of a culture which has gone nutso for blogs. The figures about the blogs being created, we talked about that. And the fact is that they're not just people talking about their private lives, like Emily Gold, but they're also people talking about politics and actually swaying public opinion with that. And you mentioned the phrase digital Darwinism. Can you sort of tell us how that all ties in together?
Well, I don't have any problem with people expressing their views on blogs. A blog really is no different from a meeting we have with friends or a telephone call where we express ourselves. The problem, though, with the blogosphere, in my view, is that for every blog that we write and for every blog that we read, where we're not reading a formal newspaper article, and we're more and more reliant on opinion. So the problem with the development of the blogosphere is that it's increasingly a culture of opinion, of subjectivity, and people are less and less knowledgeable about the world. It's no coincidence that just as the blogosphere has exploded in terms of its number, its economic viability, so newspapers are more and more in crisis. More and more newspaper journalists are being laid off. And I think I would encourage your listeners to see a causal relationship between the decline and crisis in the newspaper business and the rise of the blogosphere. Now, I've got nothing against opinion, but when we have a culture purely of opinion, often a culture of opinion which is authored by anonymous people, then I'm very troubled, because I think newspapers, while they're easy to criticize, and I acknowledge that we'll have a caller who will say, well, what about Judy Miller? What about Jason Blair? I acknowledge that newspapers aren't perfect, and indeed part of the purpose of this call is to criticize the New York Times for publishing the Emily Gold piece. They're still ultimately the most reliable source for understanding the world, whereas the blogosphere is much less reliable. It's supplementary. The blogosphere is great if you read a newspaper, if you read a magazine, if you listen to NPR. But if you rely exclusively on the blogosphere for your version of the world, then I think that view of the world is very likely to be skewed, biased, and very chaotic.
Well, can't you argue that journalism was in decline before the rise of the blog, that just kind of came in on what had already been going on for a long time, a decrease of funding in newsrooms and a decline in readership and listenership, that blogging just came in on the tail end? And who knows, maybe blogging could be adding a bit of fresh life to journalism.
I think that's true. I think it would be unfair to argue that the decline of newspapers has been caused by blogging. I think the causal relationship is more complex. What I would also argue is that the culture of narcissism existed before the invention of the internet. Christopher Lash was writing books about narcissism, so was Daniel Bell in the 1950s. And I think that television and the development of reality television and call-in radio and shows like American Idol, where the audience becomes the star, is also symptomatic of our culture of narcissism and the dumbing down of culture. So I would absolutely agree. What I would argue with the internet is that it represents a kind of climax of narcissism. And it's no coincidence that the technology that enables blogging was created by the countercultural libertarians that came out of the 1960s in Northern California. I think we have to understand technology has cultural and sociological significance as well. It doesn't just come from nowhere. And I think what all this speaks of is a culture of libertarianism, where we're more and more focused on our own views and less interested in relying on the views of others, particularly experts, whether they're journalists or academics. I mean, one step from the blogosphere is a site like Wikipedia, where anyone can become an encyclopedia editor, where anyone can become an expert. So all this is bound up, and I argue this in my book, with the crisis of expertise and what I call the cult of the amateur.
What about some of the political blogs that have gained a lot of traction, and blogs like Andrew Sullivan's Daily Dish, The Huffington Post, Instapundit? Do you see those blogs as being part of the problem, or maybe part of the direction we should be heading in terms of responsible blogging?
I would say neither, actually. I think those are interesting phenomena. Sullivan used to be the editor of The New Republic. He figured out this media pretty quickly. He built a very popular blog, and now I think works for Atlantic Monthly. So I don't really actually, when it comes to Sullivan, see that much difference between what he does in traditional journalism and what he does online. Although, and I was looking at Sullivan's blog yesterday, his pieces that he writes are terribly short. They, for the most part, they're just links to other pieces. I think Andrew Sullivan is a very, very smart journalist and a very interesting guy. He has a lot of interesting ideas about the world. I would still prefer to read Andrew Sullivan in a magazine or a newspaper than online. I think it challenges his intellect a lot more. And I think his work for the London Times is a lot better than his work online. When it comes to Arianna Huffington and the Huffington Post, she is just, if you like, a next-generation William Randolph Hearst. She is a digital version of Hearst. The Huffington Post, she calls it a blog, but in reality, it's a digital newspaper. What troubles me about the Huffington Post is that Arianna figured out a very clever model for building an online newspaper. She found all her wealthy, well-connected friends and convinced them to write for free. Now, that's great if you're a Hollywood person or an entertainment or media person and you have the leisure time to write a couple of articles for Arianna on a weekly basis for free. It's not great, though, if you're a young journalist who needs to put food on their table and pay the mortgage and send one's kids to school. The problem with the Huffington Post is that the majority of the writers on it are not economically rewarded. They're doing it to build their brand. But these are pre-existing brands. So again, it undermines professional journalism. It undermines people who write for a living. So I think that the Huffington Post is a good product, and I think that Arianna Huffington is a very, very talented, a very special person. But I'm troubled with the way in which implicitly her model undermines professional journalism and means that more and more of the voices online are going to be people perhaps like myself who already have a living from something else, whether it's a book, a TV show, a job, and then do journalism on the side. That represents the demise of professional journalism. I still want to see the survival of journalism as a trade where people are paid to write.
And talking about these blogs, you don't really have to pay for almost anything you read online. I know that Salon has tried to include a premium service, and the New York Times had a section a while back as well that you had to pay for. And those things tend to go away after a while. They don't seem to work. People like to get their content for free. So I guess you're saying
free,
you're worried.
And I argue, and some of your listeners will probably have a stroke when I say this, that free is bad. You get what you pay for. And when you get something for free, it's generally of a low quality. Or at least you're not thinking through the process. The problem with the blogosphere, and I call this the Great Seduction. I have a whole chapter in the book entitled The Great Seduction. The problem with the blogosphere is it promises young journalists that they can go online, set up their journalistic blogging shingle, they'll get thousands of readers, and they'll monetize their content through Google advertising. The problem with that is it isn't true. The problem is that even vast traffic on a blog doesn't, for the most part, economically reward the writer. In my book, I talk about one very prominent Silicon Valley blogger. I think he's in the top 50 or 100 bloggers in the world, a guy called Guy Kawasaki, who's a marketing maven. And I think it was in 2006, in spite of the fact that he got millions of page views, he only earned about $2,500. So again, it's not a viable alternative for a young listener out there who wants to become a journalist, who wants to be paid for their work. I would still strongly suggest, if they're lucky enough to find a job at a local newspaper or a local radio station. It's a much, much better way of making a living, of being paid for your work, than just writing a blog. Blogs are great. The internet's great as a marketing and sales platform. If you already have a product, a book, a movie, if you're already a well-established person like Arianna Huffington or Andrew Sullivan, but if you're not well-known, then it's very, very hard to build a brand on the internet.
Well, one last question before we take a break. We are heading into political high season, and we've got a social networking culture that has really boomed even since the last election. Where do you see the blogs and the amateur reporters fitting into this next election?
I think they're important. I think it's exaggerated. I've got a paperback version of my book coming out in the fall where I argue that I don't think the internet has really changed the political process. I think it's exaggerated. You know, the great events in this election were all physical events. The reason why Obama is such a success is because he's a great public speaker. It's got nothing to do with the internet. Now, the internet's been valuable for Obama in terms of raising money. I acknowledge that. The problem with the social networks is they tend to simply be echo chambers. They tend to be places where we go to confirm our pre-existing views. So when it comes to politics, we have the existence of Democratic blogs and a network of Democratic social networks. The same is true on the Republican side. I see very little evidence of those two worlds coming together. I see very little evidence on the internet that there's serious discussion between people of different political opinions. When people of different opinions tend to meet on the internet, my experience is they spend their time insulting one another. So the internet, my fear is, as a medium, when it comes to politics, is it simply an echo chamber. We go on it to confirm what we already think. So the left go to left-wing social networks, the right go to right-wing social networks. It's not really democratizing our political culture. It's not really resulting in more serious political discussion. It actually is resulting in fewer people of different political opinions meeting and talking to one another.
We're going to take a quick break now and then come back and rejoin Andrew Keen. We're talking with him this hour about his book, The Cult of the Amateur. He is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, and his writing has appeared in the Weekly Standard, Fast Company, and the San Francisco Chronicle. Hoping you'll join our conversation this hour as well and tell us whether you think the internet will change the next election, if you've seen evidence of that, and what you think of the information you get maybe from blogs. Maybe you read the Huffington Post or the Drudge Report, or maybe something which is a little more off the beaten track. Call us and tell us about that at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 12:30, join us for Chapter a Day as Jim Fleming concludes his reading from Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain by neurologist Oliver Sacks. That's Chapter a Day coming up at 12:30 today. Veronica Rickard back with you. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn as we talk with Andrew Keen, who's author of the book The Cult of the Amateur. And Andrew Keen, we have callers on the line here. So let's go ahead and take a phone call from Richard in Fort Atkinson.
Hi. The significance of the Emily article to me was that it is emblematic for me of the decline of the New York Times, which it also reflects the decline of life in this country. I just came off of a month and a half in Europe reading Die Welt and Frankfurter Allgemeine, and frankly, there is no longer any comparison at all. But what struck me really hard about that article was not the article itself, but the juxtaposition with the next article in the magazine, which was about a young man who was injured in Iraq to the point of incapacity, and now here back at home, he is being cared for by his mother in poverty. That article was right next to the Emily article, an article which is terrifically sad and has a lot to say about our political state, next to an article of someone, as your guest calls it, narcissistic, totally vacuous, with erotic photographs, by the way, about her relationship with her laptop computer. I'm more disgusted at the New York Times than I am by Emily. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Richard. Andrew Keene?
Well, I completely agree with Richard. I think that's a very important point. I think that one of the things that we have to understand in terms of the juxtaposition that he so appropriately underlines is that the Emily stuff is so bound up in a real crisis of community and of conversation. The Web 2.0 idealists, the digital utopians, talk about the internet being a place of collaboration, community, and conversation, the three holy C's of the internet. And none of those things are really true. The reality of the internet is I think it reflects a crisis in our world, in our real society, in the physical world, of collaboration, conversation, and community. You only have to read Emily to understand that. Here's a woman who's just totally cut off from the world. She has no friends. She's going through a kind of a mental breakdown, which is both a cause and a consequence of her obsession with self-broadcasting. And, of course, in that kind of world where no one's talking to one another, you have monstrosities like the Iraq War, which the government's able to essentially smuggle through while we're all busy online expressing ourselves. We have this catastrophe of the Iraq War. So I think Richard's point's a very, very important one, and I think sociologists in the future will look back at that particular magazine and say, how could Americans of that generation allow this thing to happen? Why aren't more people like Richard exposing this, you know, using this word exposure, and critiquing it?
Are you familiar with, I think it's James Surowiecki's book, The Wisdom of the Crowd?
Yeah, it's a book that I strongly disagree with. For those people who have read the book, I urge them to read my book as well. I think it's entirely wrong. I think it's premised on a lot of false assumptions.
Well, he tries to make the point that if you've got a certain number of conditions meant, like online, if you have independence of members, decentralization, diversity of opinion, then the gathering of sort of an online crowd around an idea or an issue can be a really good thing. What do you think is wrong with that argument?
It doesn't work. There's no evidence of it. I mean, the people... Why would you go online to make friends when you can make friends in the real world? Why would you go online to become part of a crowd to determine decisions when you should be actually doing that in your real community? So I don't really see any evidence. And the problem with the wisdom of the crowd premise online is it's very easy to game. It's very easy to corrupt. So when you look at supposed wisdom of the crowd sites like Wikipedia or Dig or Reddit, they tend to be dominated by Emily's generation. They tend to be dominated by young people who have nothing better to do with their time than spend hours and hours online expressing themselves, arguing with others, gossiping. So it's simply in real life, it's a seductive abstraction, the notion of the wisdom of the crowd. But in real life, it doesn't work. And, of course, in real political life, look what the wisdom of the crowd has produced. George Bush was elected by a majority of the crowd. Adolf Hitler was elected at one point in German history by the crowd. So the crowd isn't always very wise. Often the crowd makes very ill-advised decisions.
Well, what if it allows people who wouldn't have been able to find each other to find one another, people who might have a sort of a niche interest that they would have had an incredibly difficult time before the internet, and maybe it allows them to organize around, you know, a good issue, a good topic?
Yeah, and I don't want to come on as this complete laddad. I'm not against the internet. I use it all the time myself. I think it's a wonderful tool.
You've got a blog.
Yeah, I've got a blog. It's a wonderful platform. But I have a blog as a sales and marketing platform. I'm not trying to make money out of it. I don't have advertising or anything like that on it. But the internet's great for that kind of networking. I just don't think we can exaggerate it. It doesn't replace the real world. And much of the purpose of my book is to pinprick the hype. Is to suggest that, you know, there are things like the wisdom of the crowd and this social networking obsession are ultimately resulting more in Emily Gold-style articles like Exposed, ultimately resulting in more isolation than in community. But at the same time, it's fair to say that if you live a long way away from a large city, the internet can be a very effective tool for networking. But I'm simply reminding your authors, that was a Freudian slip, reminding your listeners that the internet is not a substitution for these things, and that you can't make real friends on the internet until you meet them physically, and the online community doesn't replace real community.
Let's take another phone call now. We've got Mark on the line from Whitewater. Hi, Mark. Are you there?
Hello.
Hey, go ahead. Hi, Mark. Can you hear me?
Hello.
Yes. Are you there, Mark?
My cell phone signal just popped out. Sorry. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
Very interesting guest. And actually, I agree with most of what he says. One thing I would like to comment on, though, is that one of the problems with the traditional print and broadcast journalism is now consolidation, where you have a very few handful of corporations that control the public airwaves and the public print waves. And so blogging actually can be a counterweight to that. And the other thing to consider is that one must vet your resource, whether it be something printed or something on the internet. Just because it's printed on glossy paper doesn't necessarily mean that an expert has written it. And I'll take my comment off the air.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mark. Andrew Keane?
I think that's true. And, you know, you can look at the Emily piece. I mean, that was presumably vetted by someone. But at the same time, I still prefer gatekeepers. I know it's an unpopular term, but I think a media with editors and fact-checkers is likely to be more reliable than a media without. It doesn't mean that you won't have Jason Millers and Judy Blairs and Emily Golds who somehow sneak through. But the majority of the work in traditional newspapers, I think, is reliable. It's no coincidence that the Washington Post was the first newspaper to report the Iraq medical veteran scandal, because they had the resources, not because the journalists are better. Now, in terms of Mark's point about the consolidation of newspapers, he's right, of course. Newspapers in this country are too consolidated. Many of them are owned by large corporations, although they don't always reflect the political interests of those corporations. Having said that, though, the New York Times is still owned by a family, so is the Washington Post. So it wouldn't be fair to say that all newspapers are owned by corporations. And then look at something like NPR. I mean, in a sense, it's equivalent in the U.S. of the BBC. It's relatively unbiased. It has gatekeepers. It has fact-checkers. And that's still a more reliable resource than an entirely unmediated environment like the internet, where one never really knows what people are up to in terms of their broadcasting or writing.
And that's really your beef with something like Wikipedia as well, sort of the anonymity, I can never say that word, I'll let you say it for me, of these peer-edited sites.
Absolutely. Anonymity is the great curse. So Google, for example, has launched a rival to Wikipedia called Knoll, that's K-N-O-L, which encourages its contributors to reveal who they are. I don't trust information where I don't know the author's identity. There is no such thing, as we all know, as absolute truth. All information comes with sociocultural baggage of one sort or another. But to understand that baggage, you've got to know the identity of the author. So when you've got a medium like the internet, where a large number of its broadcasters are anonymous, it becomes increasingly unreliable. I don't use Wikipedia because I want to know the identity of the authors. It's fine for hardcore science work, but when it comes to anything cultural, anything historical, I'm very, very dubious.
Let's take another phone call. We've got Thor on the line from Milwaukee. Hi, Thor. You're on the air.
Okay, first of all, Veronica, you have a beautiful radio voice. It's A+.
Thank you.
Okay, I would like to rise to the defense of things like Wikipedia. I found it invaluable. I'm an aficionado of ancient history. I used to be a history teacher. And 20 years ago, I'm 43, I used to have to haul many history books from these libraries, but now I can zip through Wikipedia, and it's very accurate. Hello?
Do you worry about the quality of what you're getting? Do you ever worry about whether someone is changing what you're reading to suit a particular maybe historical point of view if there are debates on the research you're doing, or do you feel pretty comfortable with what you're getting?
I'm extremely impressed how accurate it is. It's all professors from around the world. It's also international. You hit the translation button. You have Italian professors and Greek professors. That's highly accurate, very impressive. And yes, the guest has many points, but he seems kind of highbrow. And we really, I don't need gatekeepers to think for myself. I've read over 200 library books in the Roman Empire.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for your call, Thor.
Bye.
Andrew Keen, what do you think about that? Do you think there's a difference between getting information from Wikipedia on the Roman Empire versus getting Wikipedia information on, I don't know, Walmart?
Well, for an erudite gentleman like himself to describe me as highbrow, I'm not sure how to take that. I take it as a compliment. look, I think the Wikipedia is great for guys like that. School teachers, people who are already experts in their subject. Wikipedia is a great first stop. What concerns me are the kids now who are using Wikipedia as a single and sole resource. The crisis that I think we're drifting into in what I call the YouTube generation is a crisis of media literacy. The guy who called up is already media literate. He's already read hundreds of books about Roman history. He knows his stuff. And he's using Wikipedia as a supplementary resource, and that's great, and that's the ideal use of it. What happens, though, when you go to Wikipedia as a 12-year-old and you know nothing about Roman history? You're entirely ignorant, and you're entirely reliant on Wikipedia for your knowledge of Roman history. We all know that Wikipedia is patchy. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it isn't. The quality of the written work isn't always of the highest standard. There are lots of errors on it. There's no doubt about that. Most troubling of all, though, there is no central editor on Wikipedia. No one's determining hierarchies of knowledge. No one's determining what's on or what's not on it. What's ironic about Wikipedia is that the entry on Stephen Colbert's notion of truthiness, his kind of joke about the subjectification of knowledge, is almost as long as the entry on the word truth, which is the core concept in Western philosophy. The entry on Pamela Anderson, the softcore porn actress, is longer than the entry on Hannah Arendt or on Joan of Arc. So it's great, Wikipedia, if you already are educated, if you already know your stuff and you know what you're looking for. But for this generation that's coming online now and is spending its life online and never goes to a library and never sees a physical book, I'm very, very worried that they are themselves going to become victims of, if you like, the truthiness of Wikipedia.
What about the idea, though, that this generation, the one that's growing up right now with Wikipedia and all of these open source media forms, is growing up being a little savvier than their parents are, because they have to be, because I think by necessity, I don't think that they think that everything they read online is true. I think that maybe their parents do when they go online and they see it in print right there on the computer screen, but maybe this generation is actually going to be more media literate.
That's the great question, and I think you've nailed it. I mean, I live in Berkeley, and we send my son to a Montessori school of quite, you know, sophisticated kids. Berkeley is a sort of a highbrow, high-tech community, and I went in to lecture some 14-year-olds yesterday at his school, and I gave them my shtick, and they all told me I was full of crap. I didn't know what I was talking about, and that they, of course, were media literate. They were media savvy. In that context, they may be right. Again, I'm fearful. I went to the UN conference on the internet last year in Rio, and I was giving a speech there. And what these guys were talking about, particularly in the non-industrialized world, were 2 billion new people coming online, and increasingly from the non-industrialized world. What happens when people are coming to Wikipedia without going to school? What happens when they use open source media like Wikipedia or YouTube as their resource for understanding the world? It's fine for a Montessori school in Berkeley, where the kids are coming from homes where there are lots of books, where they're educated by their parents about the pitfalls of the internet. But I'm very fearful in the long term. On the other hand, I'm also hopeful. And I always do these calls, and my son's always sitting in the background, and I'm always telling, you know, people, well, they don't, the young generation don't know what they're doing, and he's always screaming at me in the background, of course we do. You don't know what you're talking about. So maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I am fearful that this is a lot more complicated and problematic than most people currently acknowledge.
Well, it could end up being one of these things that divides us by social class, I suppose.
Absolutely, and I think that's the key, and that's the irony. As everyone talks about the democratization of knowledge, which the internet is implementing, the truth is that it's actually creating more dichotomy between a small group, a small class of digitally literate people, whether they're adults or kids, who knows how to use this medium really effectively and are always on the cutting edge and driving it forward culturally and economically, and everyone else who are being increasingly left behind. So the irony of the so-called democratization of knowledge is it's creating new hierarchies which reflect the increasing disparity between the wealthy and the poor in this country and between the advanced industrialized world and the rest of the world.
Going to take a quick break right now, and then we'll be back with Andrew Keen. He is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and author of the book, The Cult of the Amateur. His writing has appeared in the Weekly Standard, Fast Company, and the San Francisco Chronicle. We're hoping you'll join in our conversation this hour and tell us what you think. Do you think that the technology online is going to unite us or divide us? Has it been a positive force for politics and culture? Or has it been dragging us down? Has it been dumbing us down? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There's a lot to look forward to today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock, stay tuned for Talk of the Nation Science Friday. After 1, they'll be talking about the movie The Happening, a film starring a science teacher, plus the debate over climate change in the Senate and what the presidential candidates might think about. That's coming up at 1 o'clock on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Veronica Rickert, back with you today. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn as we talk with Andrew Keen, who is the author of the book, The Cult of the Amateur. And Andrew Keen, let's go back to the phones and take a phone call now from Laura in Madison. Hey, Laura, you're on the air.
Hi. I just caught the latter part of this conversation, but I find it really intriguing. I just had a quick question. There seems to be an underlying assumption that the printed word is more accurate or reliable than information that can be accessed on Wikipedia or on the internet, and I'm just reflecting on my own education through grade school and high school. I remember having textbooks that published total falsehoods, and so I'm wondering if this is an accurate binary, that printed word is truth and word and knowledge that's accessed online is necessarily suspect.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Laura. And Andrew Keen?
I'm not sure if I'm saying that. What I would argue, I don't think there's any difference between the printed word and the digital word, provided there are editors and fact-checkers. So the New York Times online is no different from the New York Times in physical form. I mean, even the Huffington Post now, which is a digital newspaper, is using editors. So what I would argue is that the more intermediaries they are between the author and the audience, the more likely the information is to be reliable and uncorrupt. So I'm, in an unfashionable sense, all in favor of the intermediary. The digital utopians think that it's a good thing to do away with the intermediaries. I would strongly disagree. The real value in traditional media is the ecosystem that lies between the author and the audience, the editors, the fact checkers, the publishers.
Thanks much for that call, Laura. And we take one now from Dave in Madison. Hello, Dave. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm just calling. This is how I use it, because we're all so busy out here and stuff, and we listen to guests like this on NPR, or we see the media through maybe some cable TV or just the nightly news or something to that effect, that at this point, because of situations that happen like Dan Rather or some of the plagiarism that happened at the New York Times, I find myself going to the internet to fact check. And meaning, like, I give a couple examples. One is you get this hit, and, you know, you listen to the news, you come home, and they tell you, oh, the Pentagon study came out, and they give little snippets to preach their agenda. And I'm like, really, this happened? And, boy, that's something. And then I go to, like, the Pentagon website or the Department of Defense, and I read the Pentagon study. And, oh, I find out all these things about Saddam Hussein and all this proof that he was, conspiring with all sorts of terrorists and funding them and stuff like that. And that's in some of these websites. And as far as bloggers go, I think you could tell the bloggers when they're just giving an opinion, not based on facts. And when a blogger, backs up their article with facts, you can tell. I mean, one other example, I'll let you go, but Michelle Malkin comes out and talks about how these gas executives, these big oil executives, have to go up in front of, Congress, and she makes her opinion, but then she also states, hey, guess what? Planned Parenthood had $115 million in profits last year, and they had 280,000 abortions. You know, they're making $115 million on these things. And she backs up her opinion with facts. And I guess maybe just get a comment from your guest on some of those things.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Dave. Andrew Keene.
Two thoughts on Dave's point. Firstly, I mean, he seems to be what I would call an amateur editor. He doesn't trust newspapers, so he goes online and checks the sources himself. Two thoughts on that. Firstly, how does Dave know that the stuff online is any more reliable? It sounds to me like he has a kind of political bias and that he's looking for things online which confirm his views. The second point is the majority of us don't have the luxury of time that Dave obviously has. Most of us are really busy, as he suggests, or as one of your other callers suggests. We need our news delivered fast and reliably. The great scarcity in the 21st century is time. And most of us simply don't have the time to go onto Wikipedia and edit our own stuff, to trawl around the internet checking for the truth about information in the newspaper. And ultimately, then, I think that it becomes a big turnoff. So we need newspapers like the New York Times, like the Wall Street Journal, like the Washington Post, which are for the most part reliable, which we can trust, which we pick up in the morning, where we rely on editors to put the most important stuff on the front page, and we read it. That the problem is that with this undermining of professional media, the majority of us are not like Dave. We don't trawl the internet. We're not serious news hounds. We end up simply not reading anything. We become less ignorant, and it results in the dumbing down of society. So I think we've got to stop bashing newspapers. I keep on hearing about Judy Miller and Jason Blair and Dan Rather, but those are the exceptions. The 99.9% of journalists on the serious newspapers are honest and their work is reliable. Let's remind ourselves of that and not the tiny proportion of corrupt people. I mean, we still go to doctors, even though we know that occasionally the doctor is corrupt. We still trust airline pilots, even if we know that from time to time an airline pilot will drink on the job or do a bad job. So we've got to trust journalists. I think that it's one of the great cultural crises of our age that mainstream media has become this a very defenseless punch bag. And my book is a defense of professional journalism. Someone needs to stand up for them. I'm not a professional journalist. I don't have any institutional interest here. But I think that we will regret the fact that we're destroying it as an institution when it goes away and we have nothing to replace it.
I think a lot of people would agree with what you're saying about newspapers like the Post and the New York Times. But on the other hand, they would also say that maybe it's not such a bad thing to have someone watching the watchdogs, to have
absolutely
extra
eyes.
Absolutely.
I think it's great. I think the internet is excellent in terms of giving mainstream media a punch in the behind. The problem is a kick in the behind. The problem is when it becomes a kick in the crotch and it kills the thing. So it's great for the Huffington Post to critique the New York Times. But let's not allow that critique to turn into a destruction of the media. The problem is that the blogosphere doesn't have the resources to replace the New York Times. It doesn't have the resources to do the Walter Mead medical scandal. It doesn't have resources to set up foreign bureaus. So we have to acknowledge that the blogosphere relies on mainstream media for most of its news. And if it does away with it, if it undermines its reliability and credibility, then we're left with nothing at all. All we're left with then is opinion, people commenting on other people's comments.
Let's take another phone call. We've got Donna now from Milwaukee. Hi, Donna, you're up.
Yeah, hi. I'm an internet user, and I'm a 60-year-old woman with just 2 years of college, and not rich. But I find that I just the news we have now is corporate news, and it comes from the corporate viewpoint, and that's what we get. And for instance, if there's a presidential candidate, the corporate people are going to be for the person who is going to best help and serve them. And then that's who they are going to favor, and the candidate who is not as advantageous for them, they are going to give shorter shrift from. And I find that the internet brings in voices outside of the corporate world that really do need to be heard.
So thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate that, Donna. What's your take, Andrew Keen?
Well, a couple of thoughts. Firstly, I think, you know, I respect what Donna's saying, but I think that's wrong. I don't think that, again, you want to use examples of NPR or New York Times or the Washington Post or even the Wall Street Journal. They're not simply taking corporate positions. I think this is an old chestnut which has reappeared in the digital age. It's not true. Corporations are not determining the agendas of our more serious newspapers. So this is an ongoing argument that's really existed ever since the invention of mainstream media, and I simply reject it. The other thing I would note is that, in a sense, the anonymity of the internet is an ideal vehicle for corporate interest. You find on websites like YouTube, for example, that corporations and political parties are putting out videos that are unsigned, that are very attractive and very seductive, very funny, and ultimately, and I point out this in a number of occasions in my book, are actually authored by corporations or PR groups or political campaigns. So the problem with the internet is in an anonymous media environment where there are no fact checkers, where there are no intermediaries, corporate influence is much more viable and much more dangerous.
We'll take another call now, and here is John from Madison. Hi, John, you're up.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I want to make sure, I think the author brings up many good points here. We do need that pinprick of the utopian view of the Internet, but at the same time, let's not deflate it so far that we don't see the value. I mean, I think really it's a balance. We're never going to really lose books. We're not going to really lose mainstream media. It will go down, and I know that must be terrifying, but at the same time, I see this as really almost like a generational issue, although your last caller was great that she is not in that, but this whole trusting journalists issue versus being cynical of them, I mean, I think it's no coincidence that blogging emerged out of, in a sense, a time period where there was a real frustration with the talking head, and I know everybody quotes Dan Rather, but I think that's really emblematic of the sense of, I am a network anchor, and you shall listen to me no matter what else I say. I mean, I use the Internet a lot of times utilizing mainstream media in my RSS aggregator where I can look at what the Washington Post has to say about it, what the New York Times has to say about it, what BBC has to say about it. And there's oftentimes each publication has their own spin, and those are gatekeepers, but those are gatekeepers with biases. And I appreciate that the author says we're glad to know who they are and what their bias is, but that's what I think is really useful. The other thing is I'd like to distinguish here the difference between a blog, which is pure opinion, and I think most people do understand that a blog is just someone's opinion, and the usefulness of the Internet to aggregate content, to take different sources, stick it all in one place so that when I'm busy, I can look at one page and get 16 different sources.
All right. Thank you so much for that call, John. Andrew Keen?
Yeah, I think John makes a number of very fair and intelligent points. I actually end my book with a more optimistic conclusion where I suggest that I'm excited by the future of the Internet. I think that experts, people who know what they're talking about, can use these self-publishing tools very effectively. So what I call Web 3.0, the next thing that comes after Web 2.0, the next big thing, is going to be when school teachers, perhaps that lady, the 60-year-old lady who called, people with experience, people with knowledge, the school teacher who's an expert on the Roman Empire, st- start to more effectively use these self-publishing tools to distribute their own knowledge. So what I want to see are fewer Emily Golds, 24-year-old kids with tattoos who really have nothing to say for themselves and want to use the Internet as a place to kind of broadcast themselves and their own vacuity, and instead use it to actually distribute one's own wisdom. I think that one area where it's very, very exciting is university professors and school teachers. I think that they need to use these self-publishing tools to distribute their own wisdom and indeed to perhaps monetize their wisdom more effectively. So I completely agree with John. I think the Internet's great as long as we are not seduced by the digital utopians, as long as we're not seduced, as someone like Emily Gold was, into thinking that self-broadcasting solves everything. Self-broadcasting is not a good thing unless you actually have something to say and you're educated or wise or experienced.
But, Andrew Keen, you would say, when all is said and done, you are hopeful about the possibilities of Web 3.0, as you call it.
Yeah, I'm very, very excited. The Internet's not going away. A lot of people say, oh, I'm a Luddite. I'm not a Luddite. You know, I've got as many computers and BlackBerries as anyone in Silicon Valley. I believe in the digital future. But my book is an attempt to temper the optimism, to be more realistic, to have a serious conversation, a real conversation about where this is leading, and not to believe in... I think that the generational issue is really interesting as well.
I think, I think the Emily Golds
of this world have been corrupted into thinking that it can solve all their problems. In fact, as her piece reveals...
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to jump in here. We could keep going on this, and I really appreciate your time, but we are out of it right now.
Right. Well, thank you very much. This was fun.
Thank you, Andrew Keen.
We appreciate
your time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Andrew Keen is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and author of the book The Cult of the Amateur. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.